From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll look at a new report from the Wisconsin Policy Forum about Milwaukee Public Schools' upcoming budget. Then, actor Willem Dafoe shares what it means for him to get an honorary Doctor of Arts degree from UW-Milwaukee.
It's nice that this place that I have a special feeling for is returning that special feeling. They recognize that they participated in my development and they value what I've done, so it's flattering.
Plus, we'll speak with Wisconsin's first female brewmaster as a part of our Tavern Tuesday series.
I didn't think much of it, but I noticed it because I would go to all the meetings and I'd be the only woman at the table. I didn't even realize it until many years later when I did a little research that I happened to be the first.
All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here's today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. The Milwaukee Public Schools Board is set to approve its budget for the upcoming school year this week. MPS is losing funding due to the stagnant state support and a sharp enrollment decline during the pandemic. But the district has two life rafts. A tax referendum passed in 2020 that allows for $84 million in additional spending and about $730 million in one-time federal aid. The Wisconsin Policy Forum digs into MPS's complicated financial picture in a new report. Co-author Rob Henkin joins WUWM's education reporter Emily Files to share the takeaways.
To the extent that enrollment continues to decline in the future, and MPS is forecasting a continued decline, a slowdown from the very serious about 8.5% decline that we've seen between the fall of 19 and the fall of 2021, that is expected to slow to about a 1.3% decline next year, but continued declines over the following years. And so that has an impact on that state formula that determines the revenue limit and that is so critical to MPS's operations.
Looking at the, you know, pretty big enrollment decrease that MPS saw over the last 2 years and the stagnant state funding, it seems like a pretty bad picture for MPS. But then the federal funding and the referendum come into play. So let's talk about the federal funding first. What does that mean in this current MPS budget?
So here, you know, we have nothing but good things to say about the great care that has been taken so far in terms of the spending plan to ensure that these dollars are being invested for one-time uses and are not being pumped into ongoing operations. Not that there isn't a need to, frankly, pump them into ongoing operations. But again, doing so will create a budget hole in the future when those federal funds are exhausted. So we are seeing the plan for spending those dollars. It's about $730 million. It's essentially divvied up among a few different high-priority categories. Facilities is the foremost of those, encompassing about $235 million of the money. And again, that's an effective use of one-time monies from a fiscal standpoint because you're investing in your infrastructure, you're upgrading it. It has the dual benefit of not only benefiting your students by promoting better air quality, et cetera, but also to the extent that you can use these one-time federal dollars to address some of these needs, you don't have the need to issue more debt in future budgets. And ideally, you don't have to spend as much on maintenance in future budgets because you've upgraded your facilities. Investments geared toward accelerating learning are number two at about $140 million of this $730 million component. Those include investments in both direct services to students, like for extended learning, but also in high-quality materials, professional development, parent and family engagement. So that's the second biggest category. The next biggest is health and wellness, as might be expected with COVID relief dollars.
So that federal money, it's one-time money, which you mentioned, it's good to use that money for one-time expenses like maintenance, buying new textbooks, that kind of thing. But then MPS passed a referendum in 2020 that gives the district an additional $84 million to spend And that's ongoing money that they'll get each year to spend. So what is that going towards?
So we are seeing almost half of the $84 million, about $39.7 million or 47% of that amount is going to this broad category of attracting and retaining certified educators. From what we can make out, most of that money is going to both pay for part of a cost of living adjustment that's across the board for all MPS employees of 4.7% in this budget, also helping to pay for compensation changes that were adopted in 2019 and 2020 that have certainly added some significant financial challenges to the MPS budget. So about 47% of the dollars going there. The next largest category with about 18% is additional spending on music, library, media, physical education, and visual art. Again, that was a priority established by MPS leaders. They said they wanted those referendum monies to, in part, helping to pay for some of those areas that are considered so important for student development, but that had seen declined funding and staffing over time prior to the referendum. Another big category is for professional support staff, like school counselors, psychologists, social workers, and nurses. That's comprising about 10% of the total.
As you said, most of the referendum is going towards paying for employee salary increases, basically. The school board approved this 4.7% cost of living increase for the upcoming budget. And then there's the salary schedule, which was passed right before the referendum was approved to try to make pay more competitive. And so MPS is using the referendum to help pay for that, but then they're also expecting to save money through a number of vacancies, and that those savings are going to help pay for these salary increases as well. So can you explain that a little bit more?
Yes, and I'm sure your listeners are sort of shaking their heads right now and saying, so how can that be that you're spending more money on salaries, but you're also looking at having, you know, all of these vacancy savings? And that's really, you know, one of the key stories of this budget. So first of all, let's talk about the cost of living adjustments. 4.7%, that is actually identical to the consumer price index for the period in question. Arguably, that's something that MPS needs to do. You need to keep up with inflation as a recruitment and retention priority. But the price tag for that 4.7% across the board pay increase is about $20 million. $20.2 million to be precise. And that's a real problem when your revenue streams are as flat as MPS's revenue streams outside of the special allotment of federal dollars. You know, think about if inflation stays at that level going forward, that's going to be very, very difficult for MPS to accommodate. Now, one of the main reasons they're able to do it successfully in the 2023 budget without having all sorts of other negative budgetary impacts is that they right now have hundreds of vacant positions. It's a byproduct of the very tight labor market and all sorts of other factors that, frankly, every major employer throughout our region and throughout the country is experiencing right now. They expect these high levels of vacancies to continue throughout the next fiscal year. And they have budgeted an extra $38 million worth of savings from those vacant positions. MPS officials say there are about 244 vacant teacher positions right now, just as an example. So because those positions are on the books, but they expect them to remain vacant, they generate $38 million of savings, which essentially offsets the cost of living adjustments, the increase as employees move through their various step categories, and other costs to continue needs, and really allows MPS to produce a balanced budget without any pain, and even with being able to add a few positions, both by virtue of these special allocations of money from the federal government and just their overall wherewithal to do so. So it is counterintuitive. You're adding positions at the same time that you have vacancies. And I think that's going to be a real question for MPS going forward. Can they get by without a large number of these vacant positions, in which case their fiscal challenges will be abated somewhat in future years? But conversely, if they can't, what are they going to do next year when they don't have a $38 million additional savings from vacancies?
What do you think this budget says about what students will be seeing in their schools and in their classrooms next school year?
I think the good news is that, schools are not facing any cuts. There have certainly been budgets over the past several years where the allocations going to schools have been cut, where we have seen some big drops in some central services, including some that are related to special forms of instruction. So from a very high level, it certainly appears that schools will be held harmless and will see cost to continue increases, so there shouldn't be any negative impacts. And then you layer on top of that some of the real positive impacts that may come from these initial and one-time infusions of federal money, plus the continued ramp up of the referendum spending. You may certainly see some benefits there. I think one other key question that I should touch upon is that to the extent that expenditure of referendum dollars involves the hiring of new staff, again, this interplay between vacant positions and wanting to hire in new strategic areas, there's a conflict there. And at what point do MPS leaders decide, because either it's too difficult to actually find and hire staff or for other reasons, that maybe we just can't invest these referendum dollars in these new staff positions and maybe we have to redirect them to other areas?
Rob Henkin is president of the Wisconsin Policy Forum and co-author of a new report on the 2023 fiscal year MPS budget proposal. He spoke with WUWM's education reporter, Emily Files. The MPS board is holding a public hearing on the budget tonight and will meet again Thursday to approve the spending plan. You can look for updates at WUWM.com. Actor Willem Dafoe has received 4 Academy Awards nominations, has been in over 100 films, and has over 30 years of experience in experimental theater. He now also has an honorary Doctor of Arts degree from his alma mater, UW-Milwaukee, and he gave the commencement address for the class of 2022 this past weekend. Dafoe is from Appleton, Wisconsin, and he attended UWM in 1973 and 74 before leaving to become a part of Theater X, which started as a UWM faculty student workshop and then became an independent experimental theater company. Some of Dafoe's first acting gigs were on UWM stages. This past weekend, while he was in town for the commencement, I met with Dafoe at the Main Stage Theater on campus, where he first performed as a student. Willem Dafoe, welcome to Lake Effect On Site. It's such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So we're sitting here in the same theater, on the same stage that you performed on over 40 years ago as a UWM student. How does it feel for you to be in this space? What memory is coming back to you right now?
I'm thinking about those shows. I'm thinking about what kind of person I was in those days, about what I loved, what I hated, what I was aspiring to. I'm getting a flood of memory. This place was has a place in my mind and my memory. It's not lost, it's still there.
When you were first nominated for an Oscar in 1987 for Platoon, you said in this interview with Stephen Colbert that you were, quote, a dopey actor working down in a little theater. So I'm curious, what was your identity when you were here at UWM?
I was a dopey kid from Appleton who wanted to be around these people that were making theater in a university setting. And that was it, because my accent was very much on the theater department, probably to a fault. I look back on it and I took very few courses. I really jumped into production courses here and got very involved. That's not what I recommend for everybody, but for me at the time, I had ants in my pants, and that's what I needed to do. So I look back on it very fondly.
So you're focusing very much on theater production. When you were working through those short-term goals?
I felt like
goals.
A little kid, also because I was 17. I hadn't yet graduated high school. I had lived in a much smaller town, Appleton, Wisconsin, about 50, 60,000 people. So Milwaukee was the big city to me. I was living, couch surfing. I was living in a very hand-to-mouth way. I was taking jobs to, pay for my time here. So it was an adventure, but I always felt a little bit like I was an imposter, both as a student and as a, aspiring actor.
Well, even though you say, you felt like an imposter, was it your dream or ultimate goal as a student that the stuff you would learn here, you would take to stage or film elsewhere? Did you know that being a performer was it for you?
The beauty of being young is I didn't look that far in advance. I was just happy to be around, people that I thought were interesting, that were doing interesting things. I was learning things. I had things that were being required of me that had never been required before. I was very independent. It was a whole new life. So it was very exciting. So I wasn't even thinking about career. I wasn't even thinking about what would go next. I remember even there were moments where I thought, well, if this doesn't work out, maybe I'll join the Army. Can you imagine that?
Well, you said it was challenging, you're couch surfing, taking on various jobs, just trying to sustain yourself week to week. Did you have a favorite part of Milwaukee that you'd go to for escape or for comfort?
I didn't have that much free time between working and being a student, and I didn't have money. So it's not like I had this leisure time. So I did like going to the lake. I got a little nature boy in me, and that was about as good as it gets around here. I was mostly living and working not far from the university. I lived on Farwell for a while, Farwell Avenue. There was a bar on Downer that I used to meet friends at, and I used to go to the Downer Theater.
Those Love are the Downer memories. Theater.
Yeah, that was important because I remember that was, a lot of students get exposed to foreign film or art film through film societies. Well, because I think there were so many students that weren't living here, there wasn't a strong film society that I knew of here. But the Downer picked up the slack by presenting really good programming. So I remember seeing some good art films there and some good, some beautiful things. Yeah.
One of the last films I saw at the Downer, because I kind of choose my movies and the setting that I want to watch them in, and Nightmare Alley was perfect for the Downer.
Downer still exists?
It does, yeah.
Wow. Good.
Yeah. So
good.
I saw Nightmare Alley in the Downer, and I'm curious what stands out to you
was
about...
Was it a Downer?
No, it was excellent.
Sorry.
It was the perfect environment for that kind of film, felt like, because it had that same atmosphere.
And I also remember going to the Oriental as well.
Yeah, Oriental's still here too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so when it comes to Nightmare Alley, what stands out to you about working with Guillermo del Toro? Because I know you will work on films specifically to work with a director.
It's so true. He's filled with a lot of joy. He lives and breathes cinema. He's very articulate. I just like being around him. And it was a production that was quite muscular. Just a pleasure. I always say that, the best directors for me are the directors that make a world so complete that when you enter them, you know what you have to do. You're not inventing, you're being, you're inhabiting, you're having something happen to you. And he creates that situation. He's a master at his craft. He's very knowledgeable. One of the reasons I got to know him well was he was helping us with press on At Eternity's Gate when we were, lobbying for the Academy Award campaign, because I was nominated that year for that role, which is when I played Van Gogh. And he sponsored some of these screenings, and he spoke more beautifully about the film than the director, Julian Schnabel, or I could. And I was really impressed by that. That created a bond.
So you've been in well over 100 films and have embodied so many characters. So at this point in your career, I'm curious what influences what roles you take on. Are you looking for specific things, say, in a script or a type of character? How does a project pique your interest?
Director is very important. I look at the script, say, do I want to do these things? Do they interest me? There's a little bit of, would I want to see this movie? Would this be a good adventure? All those things. It's not really based on a character. Also, you want something to do. You want your feet held to the fire. You want some sort of challenge, because that's going to kick it up. And fly or fail, it's going to be an experience. And that's what you look for. And you try to find the right people to do that with. That's basically it. But traditionally, a lot of actors talk about script. Script is a blueprint. It's not the most important part sometimes to me in a film. It's great to have a good story, but film is a lot more than story. It's about music, cutting, camera, light, location, tone, all these things. And also a great script that isn't realized, who cares? So I usually go with people, and as far as character, you don't know what a character is until you do it.
So speaking of character, I'm wondering on the flip side, when you're done with a project, how do you put a character to bed, so to speak? Do you have any rituals or things you like to do to reset before you move on to the next thing?
I think some films, some characters linger, some don't. You're activated by the camera, you know. You become that character when the circumstances that let that character come out are present. When those go away, the character tends to, you know, kind of wither away. Unless you learn something that may not be the character, but sometimes I learn something that stays with me and impacts on me and will stay with me to the next thing. But usually then that gets bumped or trumped or changed by the next thing you're doing, because there's always kind of that process of cleansing, and you don't want to go to the same well. Not as a point of pride, but it's just not as much fun to repeat things.
So you're perhaps best known for your portrayal of villains, but what is the appeal to you in playing the anti-hero?
I think it depends on what films you watch. I got to make a little case in my defense. I probably play more characters that are not villains, but the more commercial movies, I tend to play villains or unsavory characters.
Are they just complex rather than villains?
Well, no, I just think that I had some success with that early in my career, and that commercially, that's I was like a go-to guy for that. Where in the independent sphere and the international film sphere, they know me from different things, and I have different opportunities there. But playing villains is fun. You get to do things that you can't do in life. It's like a guilty pleasure. It exercises, you know, I'm a nice boy from Wisconsin, God-fearing and all that, so it lets me be a bad guy. There's some fun in that. It's fun to be bad. But also, I go back to this thing of whenever you play a bad guy, you got to give him his day in court. You develop the good side of him. You try to have a complex character, so you're not thinking of him being a bad guy or a good guy. Those are kind of lazy labels. And villains sometimes describe a character, and sometimes they describe, or anti-hero, as you said, or antagonist, whatever you said. Sometimes that identifies how they function in the story. And sometimes I identify with those people more than the hero, because those are sometimes where the most interesting perspectives lie, because they're representing a perspective that challenges the norm, challenges the thing that we all live by. And I think that's important. Even if sometimes it's a little uncomfortable or a little unsavory, it pushes us to say, what is our true nature? What is that thing that makes us go towards, you know, bad behavior?
So one of your most notable roles, and especially you've had a recent homecoming to it, was the Green Goblin. And are you familiar with the meme of Norman Osborn saying, I'm something of a scientist myself?
I am.
What do you think of that as part of your legacy?
It's fine. You know, if people have fun with stuff, I'm happy for them.
Yeah. So being a performer, you've had a pretty nomadic life too, but I'm curious, what Midwestern qualities do you think have stuck with you?
It's hard to separate Midwestern qualities from, you know, my family qualities. But since my father was born in Wisconsin, but then he was educated out east, and my mother's from Boston, still, I think I have a lot of my father's values about hard work and being self-sufficient and very kind of puritanical, work hard, strong work ethic, discipline, don't, you know, lean on anybody. Maybe that's not Wisconsin, but I associate that a little bit with how I grew up, because the community I grew up with, I always associate, through the years I've worked a lot in Germany, and I felt like it was a very Germanic culture when I was growing up. So I think that stays with me in some ways for good, in some ways for not so good.
So you left UWM and went to New York to act, and now you're back here. We're speaking the day before. You're going to give the commencement address to the class of 2022 and also receive an honorary Doctor of Arts degree. So what does it mean to you to get this degree from UWM and to be back here?
It's an honor, and it's fun to come back here, and it affords me a particular reflection on my life. And it's nice that this place that I have a special feeling for is returning that that special feeling, that they recognize that they participated in my development and they value what I've done. So it's flattering. It's flattering because I didn't have a classic, you know, education. I'm happy that they recognize that there are different roads to take that don't necessarily negate what they're doing here. In fact, what I did may be have something to do with what's going on here even now.
Willem Dafoe was an actor on both stage and screen, and he was the 2022 commencement speaker for UW-Milwaukee this past weekend, where he also received an honorary Doctor of Arts. We spoke on Saturday at the Main Stage Theater at UWM. In about 10 minutes, we'll tell you about the Pink Boot Society and hear from the first female brewmaster in Wisconsin. But first, we'll look at a new book on diversity, equity, and inclusion work and how it can help both employees and employers. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. DEI, or diversity, equity, and inclusion work, has become an integral part of many workplaces, including here at WUWM. These trainings are intended to make a workplace more inclusive and open to diversity in all its forms. This work is the latest attempt at creating more equitable spaces for people of color, women, and others who have often felt excluded. It's a struggle Deanna Singh knows all too well, which is why she wrote her book, Actions Speak Louder, a guide to creating an inclusive workplace. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to explain more.
Were there experiences in your professional life that really pushed you to write this book?
You know, that is such a wonderful question. And it absolutely started with my own personal experiences. I think there are some professional things that tie to it and kind of personal too. So the personal side of it is just that there are many times in my career where I really, really loved the work that I was doing and I was working really hard, but was finding that I was coming up against obstacles that I didn't see many of my peers coming up against. So whether it was not being able to find mentors, not being recognized in meetings, not having my ideas elevated or having them just flat out stolen, just things along my career that really were challenges that made it harder for me to thrive. On the professional side, you know, one of the things that I've gotten to see as a consultant in the diversity, equity, and inclusion space is that I work with a lot of amazing leaders, amazing, amazing organizations. And all of them have what I think is a very genuine interest on creating the most inclusive, you know, workplaces that they can. I never have met anybody to this day, Joy, never met anybody who's like, I want to create an exclusive workplace. I don't want people to be happy here. I just don't know that that's what anybody's motives are. And so the motives are all there, right? The intentions are all there. But I think one of the things that I've seen is just that people don't know what that means. They don't know what it means to create an inclusive workplace. Like they need something, not just theoretical, but they need something really tangible. And so I think in this book is really a response to both of those things. One, kind of a little bit of a throwback, right, if you will, to what I wish could have been done in different points of my own career, which, you know, would have made a really big difference. So just that personal aspect of being able to be in it and experience those exclusionary behaviors. But then on the other side, also just knowing that there's such an hunger and such a desire to be able to implement these ideas of inclusion, but not really knowing what the roadmap should look like. So that's what motivated it. You know, that's what really got to this idea of how can we get our actions to speak louder.
As you say, this isn't easy work. There are a lot of companies that are engaging in DEI work right now, my organization included. And it requires a lot of introspection and exploration of often very complicated dynamics. For companies and people who find this daunting, what do you suggest is a good starting point?
Well, Joy, I did write a book. But I do think that it is important to think about where you want to go. I think that's one of the number one things I see organizations take a misstep on. And it seems really simple. But what I often see is that, you know, an organization gets really excited, they want to do things. And so they start, you know, kind of throwing a bunch of spaghetti up against the wall and seeing what's going to stick, as opposed to really taking a step back and approaching it the same way that they do other things that are strategic for them and their organization. So what do you do when you're putting a strategy together? Number one, you step back, you think about where are we trying to go? And then you think about what are the things that we could use that would get us to where we're trying to, what we're trying to accomplish. And so that is the number one thing that I think organizations should do, is really stop thinking about it as this piecemeal, you know, program here, a little thing here, a little thing there, and more of a comprehensive approach to what they are trying to achieve.
Well, and maybe that gets to this question to some extent, but what would you say are some of the common misconceptions of this work?
I think one of the things that I see a lot is that people feel like this has to be really hard. And if it's not hard and it doesn't hurt, then they're not achieving something. And it's not to rose-colored glass, you know, what's happening. There are a lot of things that make diversity, equity, and inclusion work really challenging. There's a lot of history here, a lot of sociology, right? A lot of things that we're doing in our behaviors that can be harmful. So again, not to sugarcoat or put rose-colored glasses on when we look at those things, but this doesn't have to be something that's always coming from a place of heaviness. It can also be something that really comes from a place of joy. And so in our organization, one of the things we really focus on a lot is how do we shift that paradigm? How do we start looking at these moments as opportunities, not as something that we have to do from a compliance standpoint, not as something we have to do because of guilt, but really as, no, this is a business opportunity for us. This is an opportunity for us to be able to live more fully in our values also. And because of those things, we want to continue to move forward. I think that that's a really important distinction that we try to help our clients see, because when you're doing something out of guilt or you're doing something because it's just out of compliance, it doesn't have the staying power, right? It doesn't have the ability to really change culture. But if you're doing something out of joy and opportunity, that's where you start to see sustainability.
As we look at sustainability, especially, one of my personal concerns when we've talked about DEI work in the past has been, there are a lot of grand plans, but there are fewer ideas on how to ensure these plans are being met. How do we keep these promises that we make to ourselves?
So I think that comes back to the idea of having a strategy. Every good strategy has some kind of accountability that's built into it. I see organizations thinking that the only way to address some of these inclusionary opportunities or this kind of workplace of inclusion is to do these big, broad, huge, sweeping things. Whereas we really try to focus on what are some things that are tangible and pretty adjacent to what you're already doing. This idea of how can you do what you're doing, but do it better. And the reason for that is because it's not that we don't believe in the big transformative changes, but we also understand that you have to build some of those milestones along the way, right? Things that people can step on. You can't just throw a mountain in front of people. You have to give them some footholds along the way. And those are really important. So I think that holding a strategy, number one, two, making sure there's accountability in the strategy, and three, making sure that the items that you've put there are things that are in proximity, adjacent enough that allows for you to make those big transitions and big transformations, but still close enough that you can actually achieve something, right? People get worn out when they feel like, oh, that's too big. That's too heavy. That's too far away. I'm not exactly sure how we're going to do it. And so they will often opt to do nothing. And that to me is one of the scariest things that could happen.
Now, DEI work has its critics. What would you say to people who think this kind of work is unnecessary?
So I think that we are seeing in real time what happens when organizations are not inclusive. Right? Everybody is talking right now about this great resignation. People are leaving their organizations and they're making choices. And the reason why people are leaving, right? Ultimately, sometimes it could be, yes, for pay. Sometimes it can be for a better opportunity. But we're seeing a lot of people leaving because they're not feeling like they can fully thrive as individuals. If there's one thing that we learned during the pandemic, it's that the separation that was never really true anyways, right? Between work and life is really, really, really not real. We used to be able to pretend that it was real, right? People would leave the office, they'd cross that threshold, and then they would be in this other space. During the pandemic, we were inside of people's homes. And I think that that helped us understand that that line, one, first of all, never really existed. And two, that it doesn't have to be deployed the way that it was in the past, where people were expected to come and sort of assimilate to whatever that culture was and not to bring their whole selves. That expectation is here. It's happening. It's in real time. And I think it's really scary to me, the organizations that are not willing to embrace it, because I think that they're going to be the ones who have a very, very hard time, not only being able to make it through this moment, but also to survive beyond it.
Well, Deanna, thank you so much for joining us once again here on Lake Effect.
It is always a pleasure. Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Deanna Singh is the Chief Change Agent for Uplifting Impact and the author of Actions Speak Louder, a step-by-step guide to becoming an inclusive workplace. She'll be at the Milwaukee Public Library Centennial Hall on June 6th for an event with Basel Books and Rooted MKE. Did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Well, if you'd like to take us on the go or hear any of the segments on the show, just search for Lake Effect in Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts to listen to us on demand. Next, we'll learn about the Pink Boot Society, an organization that supports women in the brewing industry, and we'll hear from one of its founders. That's next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's time now for our Tavern Tuesday series. We're partnering with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin to bring you stories about beer and brewing in our state. We'll be sharing these histories leading up to the grand opening of Old World Wisconsin's new brewing experience. The majority of Wisconsin brewmasters are male. It wasn't until 2005 when Jamie Bartsch became the first female brewmaster in the state and was the only one at the time. She didn't know if there were other female brewmasters until she received a visit from Terry Fahrendorf, a Wisconsin native and Oregon-based brewmaster. Eventually, they founded the Pink Boot Society, a group dedicated to training and providing career support for all women in the brewing industry. Today, we'll hear from Bartsch, who is currently the brewmaster of Moose Jaw Pizza and Wisconsin Dells Brewing Company. But first, Lake Effect's Mallory Chang speaks with Dave Driscoll, the curator of economic history at the Wisconsin Historical Society.
Thank you so much, Dave, for being here on Lake Effect for this Tavern Tuesdays. I really appreciate you being here today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Another collection item in the Historical Society are these bright pink rubber boots. Whose boots are these, and what do they represent within our state's brewing history?
These are pink boots that were worn by Jamie Bartsch, who is the head brewer at the Wisconsin Dells Brewing Company. And these are emblematic of an organization called the Pink Boot Society, which Jamie was a co-founder of. And the Pink Boot Society is an organization of women involved in the brewing industry. As you might imagine, this has been a heavily male enterprise, and it's been difficult for women to sort of get trained, you know, get hired, get promoted. And so Jamie was one of the pioneers, and it just so happened that another pioneer who was from Wisconsin, but I think working in Oregon at the time, a woman named Terry Fahrendorf, decided to just do kind of a tour of breweries and meet all the women that she could that were working in the industry. And it turns out when Terry came by Wisconsin Dells to kind of introduce herself to Jamie, both of them happened to be wearing pink boots. And that kind of was the inspiration to create an organization that would promote and encourage and train women in the brewing industry. So it's kind of a membership group, but it's also educational. They have scholarships, they have seminars. They're basically dedicated to helping women succeed and advance in the brewing industry.
Were these the exact boots that Jamie was wearing when she met Terry, or are these just like one of her many pairs? I'm assuming she has many pairs of other pink boots in her collection.
I do not think these were first generation. You know, boots wear out. Jamie became the first female brewmaster in Wisconsin in 2005 and met Terry Fahrendorf in 2006. We collected the boots in 2017. So I think, no, boots aren't going to last 11 years. I had the pleasure of visiting Jamie and talking to her a couple of years ago and asked about, you know, why pink boots? And she said it was kind of a authority thing. Now, there's an awful lot of kind of cleanup work and scut work in brewing that you just pop things down and sterilize them and hose them and clean them. And you know, there's just an awful lot of that kind of work. So in any given day, there are people wandering around with mops and squeegees and stuff and boots, you know, kind of cleaning stuff up. And it's typical. Everyone just wore black boots. And even after she demonstrated her skills and was hired as brewmaster, people just assumed if she was walking around in black boots like everyone else, she was, you know, kind of a low-level employee. But they just kind of look at the boots, oh, you're a cleanup person. So she started wearing the pink boots to kind of distinguish herself so people wouldn't just assume that she's like the cleanup person. So it was really, for her, it was just a matter of getting that respect and acknowledgement.
And Jamie Bartsch joins us today as well for this week's Tavern Tuesdays to talk about her infamous pink boots. So thank you so much, Jamie, for being here on Lake Effect.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Jamie, you are Wisconsin's first ever female brewmaster. What was your journey to become a brewmaster? Why did you decide to pick up this career?
Well, it was kind of dumb luck. I was in biotech, so I liked science a lot, but I didn't know what area of science I wanted to go into, and I happened to have a class, bioreactions. And all we did in the class was make beer. Would make beer all semester, and I was pretty good at it. And all my professors were like, hey, you could be a brewer. And I was just like, wow, that's a job option. Sign me up. So then from there on, I just focused all my program classes on beer, like molecular. And I, you know, would work with champagne yeast and ale yeast. And then I needed an internship. So I applied at Moose Jaw, and actually I applied everywhere in the state of Wisconsin at that point, and nobody hired me. And I understand, I might not have hired me. So I waited 4 months later, and I came back because it was September. And then I approached the brewmaster at the time, and I asked him if I could help clean or sanitize. And he looked at me and said, you might actually know what you're talking about when it comes to brewing. So I got hired on as an unpaid intern. So I worked for free for 5 months, scrubbing floors, polishing tanks, and it was a very old world internship. He would drop little bits of information down to me as I did very manual work, but I did learn a lot. And we found out he was leaving in 2004, the company ended up deciding to stick with me, and they sent me to the Master Brewers Association's Brewing and Malting to get my degree. And I came back in 2005 and took over. And at that point, I became the first female brewmaster in the state of Wisconsin. And I noticed it. I didn't think much of it, but I noticed it because I would go to all the meetings, like Brewers Guild, Master Brewers Association, the BA Brewers Association, which is our national organization. And it was, I'd be the only woman at the table. We would have Deb Carey there, but she will even tell you that she does everything at the brewery besides make beer because she's the owner. I didn't even realize it till many years later when we always just said I was like the only one, and didn't realize till did a little research with Master Brewers that I happened to be the first.
That's a big designation to have. And later on, too, you and Terry Fahrendorf founded later on a society dedicated to supporting female and women brewmasters. And the story goes that you and Terry met up. Terry met up with you at the Wisconsin Dells Brewing Company. And by sheer coincidence, you both were wearing bright pink boots on that day. Why were you wearing them? And how did that feel to see Terry wearing the same outfit as you?
Right. I know. It was that very funny coincidence. When I was an intern, I didn't know much about actually working in a production brewery. Most of my education at that time had been through books. So I didn't even have rubber boots when I started. And the owner just gave me his black rubber boots. And when I took over, it was like everyone always mistook me for being the janitor, being there so early in the morning. And I was always kind of dirty because, you know, yeast or grain or whatever gets all over you. And everyone's like, well, is she the janitor? It's like, well, maybe if I wear pink boots, people like realize I'm the brewer and it'll stand out and be a little more significant. So I got myself some pink boots, rubber boots, and that's just what I would wear. And Terry, she's a Wisconsin girl. So I knew about her only from online. I had never met her before 2006, but I saw her post online that she had quit her job at Steelhead and was going to travel the country to one side and back to the other visiting breweries. And I had never met another female brewmaster. I didn't like really realize there were other ones. So I never thought about it. So I was so isolated. I'd never even met another woman who worked in a brewery. So I reached out to her online and I was like, please, please, please come visit me in Wisconsin. I'd love to brew a batch of beer with you and talk and, you know, find out everything. And when she came, she told me all about all these other women she met along her way as she traveled through the country and stopped at various breweries. And we all said the same thing to her. We're like, wait a minute, there's others? How do we get in touch? Is there a list? Do you have phone numbers? Like, how can we all like reach out to each other? So she started compiling a list so we could all get in touch. And then we're all like, can we have a group? And she just thought, because we had this picture of me and her standing with the pink boots brewing, that would be a good name for it. So yeah, Pink Boots got created.
Since the founding of Pink Boot Society, the society has founded chapters across the country and even around the world internationally. Did you ever imagine that Pink Boot Society would be this widespread? And how has it felt for you as one of the founding members to see the society, to see Pink Boot Society grow like this?
It's just nice seeing the growth of women in food science. You know, we now have up to 50 members in the state of Wisconsin. So it's nice. It's really nice. International, just across the world, we now are up to 2,900 members. It just warms my heart. We just expanded it. So before, I remember being at the first meeting and us all sitting around, like maybe the 20 of us that were there and discussing what the group was going to be. Are we going to be, you know, just brewmasters, because at that point that was the list. It was all just the few women that were in charge of a brewery. And, you know, are we going to let the packaging girls in? What about the lab girls? What about, you know, beer delivery drivers, distribution? What about media writers? And we decided at that point that it should be any woman whose mortgage is paid because of the fact that beer is being made. So try to take the whole scope in. But just recently, we expanded it to fermentation. So the distillers, the winemakers, the kombucha makers, you know, everyone can come to the table. And because that is also, that's going to be huge. This just happened last year. And now there's so many things you can pull and learn from those different industries. And I just can't wait to really bring those girls into the fold so we can exchange technical information or marketing information or any of that, because you just learn by getting new information and new ideas and bouncing things off of each other. And I can only imagine with all this new energy coming together, the things we'll come up with.
Jamie Bartsch is one of the founding members of the Pink Boot Society and is the brewmaster of Moose Jaw Pizza and Wisconsin Dells Brewing Company. Dave Driscoll is the curator of economic history at the Wisconsin Historical Society. They both spoke with Lake Effect's Mallory Chang. Tavern Tuesdays is a partnership with the Wisconsin Historical Society and Old World Wisconsin. The grand opening of Old World Wisconsin's brewing experience will be in June. You can find more of our Tavern Tuesdays conversations at WUWM.com. And that's Lake Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn how a recent ruling could affect government agencies' abilities to enforce laws, and the impact that could have on labor rights, the environment, and our ability to hold corporations accountable. And we'll speak with the co-founder of Mom's Mental Health Initiative to learn how the formula shortage has impacted maternal mental health. That's tomorrow at noon on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.